welcome back to another School of Science Radio. I'm Gino Ganello, as always, joined by Adam and Chris, who is back this week. Chris, hope things are feeling a little better this week, taking it back off the injury list like we hope to do with some of these Everton players moving forward.
Well, I was feeling okay until the penalty shootout this afternoon, and now I'm just
that's
sad
not true
again.
At all. You were feeling very bad for 70 minutes and then great for 20 minutes and then sad again.
Okay, yeah, that's a little bit more accurate, but I don't want to delve too far into the machinations of my own brain. That's no good for anybody.
Well, before we get to Leicester, we do have to talk about Manchester United on Sunday. Really just some quick things on them. They drew United 1-1, or Everton drew United 1-1. Own goal was our only goal in the 36th minute. Mason Greenwood had a goal in the 77th minute that tied things up for United. You know, not really too much to this game, just some things. You know, obviously there was the big story that we'll get to, but first off, let's start with how we started. Mason Holgate coming out as what looked like a central defensive midfielder there. What did you guys think of him? Adam, we'll start with you.
God, it was an experience unlike really any other. I think probably good on Duncan Ferguson to realize that a 5-3-2 with a three that would have been Tom Davis, Bernard, and Alex Iwobi maybe wasn't the way to go. I don't think anyone will be mistaking Mason Holgate for a natural midfielder anytime soon, but I mean, given what he was asked to do, which was basically sit in front of the back four and kick the ball far when it got to him, he was fine. I don't want to see him there ever again, except that we just did today, which again, for reasons that we'll talk about, but I mean,
yeah,
on the scale of things that could be bad or seem like they should be bad on paper, it was really not that bad.
Just so you guys know, against Manchester United, Mason Holgate completed 17 passes from a midfield position, which is not what you want. But at the same time, like Adam says, that, you know, passing was not really what anyone was being asked to do for Everton.
Kick
on
ball far, Chris.
Yeah.
Kick
no,
ball far.
I just pulled up his pass map while you were talking about that, and I was
what
like, oh.
What pass map?
Yeah, that's just
pass maps for anything regarding our midfield for like the past four games, because it probably won't look too.
Yeah, the Duncan Ferguson pass map era is dire. The best part about the Mason Holgate defensive midfield experiment to me was how, you know, like right before the opening whistle, the team ostensibly sets up in the formation that they're going to play in, and Holgate is in the middle between Mina and Keane, and is when the whistle blows, he hauls ass into midfield like it was some grand caper, and Ferguson's like, got him.
as if Manchester United was going to play us any differently with a 5-3-2 where the strategy was kick ball far, and a 4-4-2 where the strategy was still kick ball far.
Well, I mean, listen, I mean, of all the things that we've seen happen this week, you know, from Coutinho wearing a youth-sized jersey for Bayern Munich for the entire season and Mesut Ozil, you know, getting kicked out of a Chinese video game, I guess this probably isn't the weirdest thing that we've seen all week compared to the other things. I don't know.
I mean, have you seen Mason Holgate play before? I mean, and I will admit that Mason Holgate this season.
The strangest part about it is that he played pretty good.
Yeah, and he's been decent this season in defense up to this point. But I think, you know, I think we can probably agree that composure with the ball in his feet and decision making are not two of his strengths.
Definitely.
And it's an issue when he's playing center back. You would expect it to be a bigger issue when he's playing in the center of midfield. And like I said, it really wasn't. And that doesn't – even now, saying the words with my mouth, I'm like, is that right? Am I sure that that's what I saw? But it was. It was. Well,
the sad thing is that apparently Michael Keane caught the disease that Mason Holgate has had the first 2 or 3 years of his career. Ooh, so that's great.
That's true. Yeah,
and true. We will certainly get into that a little bit because there's a lot to talk about there. But before we get into that, let's talk about our own goal. In your guys' opinion, obviously there was a lot of talk about this. The Premier League came out and released a statement that it was the right call. In your guys' opinion, from what you guys saw, was it the right call or should it have been overturned? Chris, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly didn't even think anything of it when I watched it live on Sunday morning. I thought David De Gea and Dominic Calvert-Lewin just went up for a totally 50-50 challenge. I thought it was completely fair that Dom went after the ball in that scenario because, you know, when it goes up, it looks like either of them have a chance to get it, and that's one of those things where you can't really call a foul on it to me.
Yeah, I didn't think there was anything particularly controversial about that. Didn't look a foul. Looked to me like both guys, you know, whiffed, just completely whiffed on the ball. You know, if Dom wins that header, they're not going to call him for a foul either. They were about equidistant from it, and they both just missed. And then, you know,
God bless Victor Lindelof. Yeah,
just smacked it in with his dick like you do.
Yeah, well,
hey. It's as good a use as any. Can we use that? Is that allowed? Can I say
might,
that?
Might have to cut that part. We'll come back to it.
Moving on from that. But I agree with you guys. I think that, you know, it's hard to call a foul in that situation. It looked like, you know, even if De Gea was, you know, completely – uncontested the ball, it looks like he might have even played it a little poorly there, where it would have went over his hand anyway. I don't think there was anything in it either, so I agree with you guys, and I agree with the Premier League in the sense that it was the right call. But moving forward, what do we like about this game, Adam?
I like that we didn't concede a goal until the 77th minute. That was nice. We certainly didn't have as much in the attack to be happy with as we did against Chelsea. I thought United did a much better job of limiting the counterattack, presumably because they were a little bit more prepared for it than Chelsea was. But I mean, again, much as was the case with the Chelsea match, much as we'll talk about probably with the Leicester match today, you can only expect so much from the group of players that was out on the field at that point for most of the game. And if you offered me a 1-1 draw against Manchester United at the start of the season in a game where Mason Holgate was going to play 90 minutes at center mid, I would have bit your head off for it.
That's kind of the thing, right? Like, not to oversimplify this, but when you ask what do we like about this game, the genuine answer is that we didn't lose, and I say that because that's a true achievement for the roster that's being rolled out there at the moment, considering all of the injuries and the inexperience of the manager. We went to one of the toughest places to play in England and didn't lose.
I like that.
Yeah. No, all about it.
Yeah. No. Yeah. When you don't lose, especially in the form that we were in before the Chelsea game, you know, everything's, you know, a plus and just grabbing a point. And really when you look at it as a whole, 4 points in two games against, you know, Chelsea at home and United, you know, we'll take that.
And our away form on the whole, pretty bad.
Yeah. So we will definitely take that as a positive there. And, you know, obviously not like you guys said, you know, when you look at this game, the positive is that we didn't lose. So there were things that obviously we didn't feel great about. Chris, we'll start with you. What didn't we like about this game?
I'm going to single an individual out, and we can get to him more later, but I just have not been happy with Alex Iwobi's performances lately. He was purchased with the idea of kind of becoming a secondary creator or even a primary creator with, you know, along with Sigurdsson and maybe Bernard to some extent as well. And that just hasn't really happened. You can kind of see that he does have good ideas. He obviously does have talent. I mean, you don't spend as much time playing at Arsenal if you don't, but he has just completely been unable to impact games in any meaningful way in terms of creating chances. And I know, you know, he's got some good progressive passing numbers, and I understand that. But at some point, you do have to turn those into assists. And both against United and Leicester, I felt like he was on the fringes of the match. And when we're missing Gylfi Sigurdsson, you know, you kind of need somebody to step up. And not just missing Sigurdsson either, but missing Andre Gomez as well.
Yeah, I mean, my question would be to you now would be, do you think that it is possibly due to the fact that, you know, he doesn't have that defensive midfield behind him, you know, in the formation that they're playing, he's more out wide now, and they're playing that 4-4-2? Is it circumstantial nonsense, or you think it's just the way he's playing and he just needs to figure it out in that way?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, and I know that's kind of a cop out, but you're definitely inhibited to some extent without having, you know, the experience of Fabian Delph and Morgan Schneiderlin and even Gylfi Sigurdsson to some extent back there. But again, you know, I don't think that Alex Iwobi was purchased with a lot of stipulations, right? Like, this was one of the big moves from our summer to kind of really be the last piece in attack, right? Like, because, excuse me, you know, you had Richarlison, you had Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Moise Kean, and then Iwobi is supposed to be that final creative piece. And it just, I don't know, you know, maybe Carlo Ancelotti can get something out of him. I don't think it's a total waste of a buy just because he's very young and it wasn't excessively expensive. But right now it's trending towards me being wrong about that signing.
Yeah, and I think that the key there with Iwobi is that it is part circumstantial, and it's part not being able to find the space or have the target when he's on the ball. But part of it is just raw execution. It's just that he is on the ball and he has a pass to play, and he's just not consistently enough hitting it for a guy who's supposed to be in the role that he's in.
I completely agree, and I wonder too, not to cut you off, but if, you know, suddenly being the guy is part of what's causing this, because, you know, at Arsenal you have Mesut Ozil, you have Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Alexander Lacazette, and all these guys, and, you know, at Everton with Gylfi Sigurdsson down and Andre Gomes as well, it's kind of like, well, Alex Iwobi has to be the one who's doing this.
Yeah, and that kind of takes me into...
And Bernard was hurt as well, lest we forget.
Yeah, and Bernard, since his return, was going to bring up as well, and I don't really put that on Bernard from the United match at all. It's simply the fact that, you know, Iwobi, Walcott, even Richarlison are guys who physically are built to play a game, you know, 80 minutes in defense and 10 minutes in attack and be able to make something of that 10 minutes in attack. And Bernard is just he's not a very good defender. He doesn't have the size nor the raw pace. He's quick, but he's not fast to really, you know, make a ton of impact defensively. And kind of the upshot there is that so that he doesn't get beat, he's sitting so deep and he's not getting forward to impact the attack in any meaningful way. Again, I don't really put that on him, and it was what it was with Walcott out. If you wanted to play two strikers, that was kind of, you know, you were stuck. He had to play there. But I thought that was one thing that stood out to me from the United match that maybe was not as obvious as some other things.
There's a lot of things from this game I think you could point out, but I think, you know, in trying to move to our next topic here, the biggest thing that came out of this game was the handling of Moise Kean's substitution on the field and then 18 minutes later coming off the field before the end of the game. Obviously, we've heard what Duncan Ferguson has had to say in terms of, you know, wasting some time and, you know, not being pleased with, you know, some of the things he was doing out there. There was a tweet that was circling in defense of Keane saying, this is from Patrick Ridge, you're saying that, you know, he's having a go at the fans who are saying Keane didn't put an effort in. He ran 2.1 kilometers in the 18 minutes and had the fourth highest sprints in the entire team. you know, it seems to have been a point of controversy before this, you know, obviously today when we played Leicester and the focus shifted. How did you guys feel about the handling of this Keane situation?
Well, Adam can tell you, I was not a fan. I was
he was unhappy. Mad. He was real mad.
Well, the thing is that we have just recently seen Everton run off Nikola Vlahovic. We've seen them run off Ademola Lookman. And Moise Keane is probably more talented than both of those players. At least he's got a more significant pedigree in terms of, you know, his footballing upbringing, for lack of a better term. And in that moment, it felt a lot like, here's this guy who's never been a manager before. He's feels like he may have, you know, more sway at the club than he actually does, and who doesn't, you know, truthfully may or may not know what he's doing. This could ruin this player's Everton career all in one fell swoop, just 20 minutes gone, poof. And so, you know, obviously we get to today against Leicester City and see that that probably wasn't the case, because I don't know about you guys, but I thought Keane played well today in the cup match. And,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely. Agreed.
And he got to play for 45, you know, he played 45 minutes.
So he played the full 45 minutes. And I, you know, yeah. part of the trouble too for Moyes, I think, is that this is not a style of football that really suits him. No. And
yeah, exactly. So. Same thing. Felt the same thing. You know, I was thinking the same thing. You know, you just look at him out there today. He looks a little bit, you know, uncomfortable in this style, because he's used to doing, you know, I guess playing a prettier style of football than we're playing. But Chris, you know, Adam, before I send it over to you, I think you hit the nail on the head with the Ferguson and, you know, him having, you know, listen, I don't have any ties to the Ferguson era and knowing what he was like for Everton while he was at the club there. So this is coming from a purely neutral perspective on him, I guess you could say. You know, I think it's okay to criticize him in saying that he may not have handled this the right way in taking him off.
Well, yeah, and I think there's maybe a real sense in which Dunk feels like, you know, his tires have been pumped up a little bit, right? You know, you're coming off the big win against Chelsea, everybody's singing your name, you're doing all these touchline antics, which I enjoy, no judgment here. I've enjoyed the ball boy stuff, but like, you know, all of a sudden your legend, which was pretty big already, has grown just to an astronomical, almost unmanageable size. And I think that can affect your day-to-day decisions.
Yeah. And I think that if you asked him right now, especially after Keane puts in a pretty good shift today, I think if you asked him right now and he gave you a perfectly truthful answer off the record, I think he'd probably acknowledge now that he probably made a mistake in doing that.
I think you're right. And I think he just – what made it so much worse was when Moyes came off, Dunk didn't even look at him.
Yeah.
If you just take him by the shoulder and say, hey man, I really did just want to kill some time.
Yeah, or just even to say, you know, I set you up for failure here. This is not on you.
Yeah, exactly.
This is on me, which again, I think that privately, I think that Duncan Ferguson would 100% cop to at this point and say, you know, I didn't set him up to succeed, to do the things that I felt he needed to do. And we were not in a position to, you know, to play it out five more minutes for his pride, basically. So I made the change I thought we needed to make.
And before we wrap up on this point, I don't blame, you know, there was a certain section of fans on Twitter and whatnot kind of getting on Moyes for, you know, sulking off to the tunnel. I don't blame him at all. When I got in trouble at my job when I was a teenager, it's pretty much the same reaction, right? Like, you know,
Duncan Ferguson said the same thing. Dunk said the exact same thing. He said, if it was me when I played, I would have had the exact same reaction.
Well, Dunk probably would have like committed a partial felony or something. Well, so
yeah, he would have gone down the tunnel and beat up a ball boy on the way there rather than hugging one. But yeah, I mean, to me, if the manager's saying, hey, you know, that's what I would have done as a player too, it's water under the bridge.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's over.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think today showed that. And you know, I just, you know, thought it was something that we need to bring up. You know, there's a lot. There was a lot of on Twitter, and you know, obviously a lot of things can happen on Twitter, and a lot of people can say a lot of different things. But it felt like a lot of people were defending Duncan Ferguson and really attacking Moise Keane for, you know, not putting a shift in, as some would say, or just, you know, not playing well and whatnot. But I think there's a lot more factors to that, and I feel like a lot of people that aren't us may have a bigger connection to Duncan Ferguson and that legend that we never really got to know. So, you know,
life
and
is full of gray area. Hooray! Yeah.
and so now we arrive at the Leicester game where everything gets solved, and, you know, whatever. But we're, you know, moving towards the Leicester game. You know, Everton, obviously, as we know, we're recording on Wednesday, which Everton lost earlier today on PKs 4-2 after coming from behind. They were down 2-0 after the first half, and quite honestly, a terrible first half. Goals by Tom Davies, pretty solid goal. And then, of course, the unbelievable strike by Leighton Baines in the first minute of stoppage time there that practically blew the roof off of Goodison. You know, basically dominated Leicester. Were dominated by Leicester in the first half, and you know, towards the end of that second half, it looked like they were dominating. Everton were dominating Leicester in the, you know, opposite fashion. But I think it's easy to say. I don't know what you guys are thinking, but, you know, in moving towards praising Big Dunk here, I think he's revitalized this team a significant amount.
I think there are certainly major tactical flaws in his approach.
Absolutely, yeah.
But damn, if he does not seem like one hell of a man manager in terms of motivational tactics. And I think, you know, in hindsight, we could probably see that coming, right? Just with his outsized personality and really his ties to the club and whatnot. But even still, I've been impressed with that part of it. You're not going to find anybody putting in less than 100% when Dunk's around.
And I think, to be fair to him, he got his tactics right against Chelsea, and I, you know, we, Gino and I talked about that last week, and I thought he recognized in the second half that the 4-4-2 was not working, and he did make a shift into a 4-2-3-1 where Davies and Holgate were sitting behind Iwobi at the 10. Dom was on the left, Richarlison on the right, and Moise Keane up top. And it was really that change that was kind of the catalyst for the comeback in the second half. It was around that time that Everton started to get a foothold in the match because they had more numbers in the midfield and then were able to start creating some chances. You know, obviously, you can make the argument maybe he should have started with that alignment. It's tough to say based on, you know, obviously the way that things went against Chelsea and Man United. I don't know if you would have wanted to change things, but credit to him at least for really in three matches showing more tactical flexibility than we saw from Marco Silva in, you know, 2.5 seasons.
Yeah.
However long it was. I've already forgotten. Who's Marco Silva?
And just to back you up there, you know, Phil Kirkbride, in some of Ferguson's comments after today's game, he quoted Ferguson saying, "I thought the second half was better than the first half. Weren't aggressive enough. There weren't enough hits, but, you know, virtually the same team as we put out against Manchester United." And he did confirm that he did change the formation in the second half. So again, like you're saying, great to see him making those tactical changes. You know, obviously some of the tactics, due to the fact that moving into our next point, don't have really many players.
Yeah, he's limited in options just a little bit.
Yeah, so it's not easy to, you know, play a different style of football when they have the options that they have. But good to see him making those tactical decisions. But moving into the injuries, how much more can we really expect from this team? I feel like they've overperformed more than we really could have expected with all the injuries that we've had.
Well, they probably have overperformed, but what it kind of makes me wonder is if we shouldn't actually expect them to be beating these teams that are pretty bad, at least the next three games, right? So Arsenal, Burnley, and Newcastle. I don't know that that's – I hate to put the pressure on, but, you know, those three teams are pretty – bad, and Everton have been playing pretty well, and you may end up getting yet another new manager bump in there for the Burnley match. So
I I think the issue that we will run into is that if you're going to have a part of the pitch where you've got significant injury against good teams, against teams who are probably going to outpossess you anyway, the place where you can usually get away with it is going to be in the center of midfield.
Just steer into the skid, basically,
exactly.
Right?
Like, and you just say, okay, well, then we're not ever going to try to keep the ball. We're going to play long ball. We're going to play counter exclusively, and we're just going to live with that. Now against Arsenal this weekend, I think that'll work fine because Arsenal will absolutely try to play out of the back on us because that's, you know, who they are, and they've got the attacking talent certainly, but their midfield and defense are a mess. But if we're still talking about a midfield of Mason Holgate and Tom Davis against Burnley, which I don't think we will be. I think Sigurdsson will be healthy by then. But even still, you know, a midfield of Sigurdsson and Davis against Burnley, that's a different proposition because Burnley's going to sit deep on you and they're going to say, you know, come get us, come break us down. And I don't know how you do that with some of the guys who are currently out. And to me, that's my biggest concern. And I know it sounds weird to say, but it's almost a blessing to have played the teams that we played at this particular point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I know he hasn't had a very good season thus far, but what a huge difference would it make to have even Fabian Delph, mm-hmm. say, back for Burnley and Newcastle? I think that would make a major impact. But, you know, who knows? Maybe well, we can get to this in the managerial section, but I've seen a lot of Carlo Ancelotti football. Still don't really know what he's all about tactically because his teams have always had such superior talent.
Are you suggesting that Mason Holgate, the central midfielder, is not superior talent?
Well, I mean, compared to my Sunday afternoon church league games.
Fair enough. It's a fair point. Moving from, you know, the good of this game to some of the bad. Let's talk about the goals Leicester scored in the first half first.
I wrote down here,
first Leicester goal, ha ha ha, and then second Leicester goal, even more ha 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 ha, because, I mean, the defending on those two goals was absolutely atrocious, no?
Well, the funny thing is that I'd have to go back and watch it again, but I'm pretty confident that James Maddison was Mason Holgate's mark. I mean, he was just completely out to lunch.
Here's what happened on the first Leicester goal. And this is, I know I talk smack about Mason Holgate a lot, but he's done just about everything that's been asked of him this year. And I say this sincerely and really without blaming Holgate a whole lot. The lad thought he was playing center back. He genuinely forgot for a second he was playing center mid because it's ridiculous that he's playing center mid. He sat deep in between Keane and Mina, and as soon as a pass went out to Maddison at the top of the box, the guy he should have been marking as a central midfielder, he went, oh shit, that's right, I'm playing center mid, that's my guy, and it was too late.
That's also a good finish. Like, you know, there's a very real chance in which Maddison is marked and he still scores that the way that he shot it. So
I don't want to be hypercritical of Mason Holgate in that situation either, because really you'd be hard pressed to point to a whole lot of mistakes that he made in a position that is not his natural position. It just so happened that one of the ones he did make, he got punished for in a big way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, Maddison had, you know, tons of space there. And like you said, it was a great finish. He put it in the corner there, struck it really well. But, you know, obviously Mason Holgate not being in position helped that out a little bit. And then, of course, whatever was happening on, what was it, the corner kick that led to Johnny Evans' goal. There was three defenders in the same spot, and then Johnny Evans standing all by himself. That one
I will be hypercritical of Michael Keane about, because that was Keane's guy. Evans was Keane's guy the whole way. He was on him. The ball got deflected, and Michael Keane got distracted like a bug to shit. And next thing he knew, the ball was behind him, and so was Johnny Evans. I mean, you just at this level, it's just a basic mental error that you cannot be making. And obviously, with the way that the game went late, you know, if we're down one instead of two, and we get those last 20 minutes, who knows what happens? Who knows? And that's from a player that you expect better from in that sort of situation.
And just while we're still on things from this match that we don't like, can we talk about Yuri Mina and his apparently conical forehead?
Yes. No. Yeah.
Only good against the English national team. That's
yeah. What
the
heck, Yuri?
Cannot head the ball for club.
Oh. And that's, you know, like you were saying about Keane, you know, defending and marking Johnny Evans. If Yuri Mina should have put both of those headers in the back of the net, you know, it's 2-2 at the end of the first half, and you know, who knows what happens. Maybe it was a good thing that both of them didn't go in, but one of them would have been nice.
Yeah.
Again, it's a completely different game if one of those goes in the back of the net, and you know, it's 2-1 at the half instead of 2-0, and there's a lesser deficit to have to break down. You know, we talked about it a little bit, but Moise Keane dispelled really any controversy from Manchester United. Came on in the beginning of the second half. Thought he was pretty good. What was your guys' opinion?
I think that we talked about, you know, kind of the major thing, which is that he's not built to play in this sort of, you know, very conservative defense first approach. And that's not a critique of Duncan Ferguson either, obviously, as we've discussed, that's just kind of where we are right now. But I mean, we saw when he gets the ball in space, he is dangerous. You know, he got the ball probably that was right after the first goal. He got the ball out in that right central channel with a little bit of space in front of him, and he did about 52 step overs, absolutely shook a guy, and dropped a cross right onto Dominic Calvert-Lewin's head that, you know, could have very, very easily tied the game with 15 minutes to play. And at that point, I don't think that you would have picked against Everton getting a third and winning it in regulation. He was also quiet for long spells because he's not a particularly physical dude. And Leicester had three center backs on, and we were just lumping balls into the box. But it was encouraging to see him go out there, put the right effort forward, and showcase a little bit of the skill that he's got, and in hopes that when we've got something that can resemble more of a regular lineup, he can really shine the way that we hoped he would when we originally signed him.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that other than just to kind of reemphasize Adam's last point that I think that at some point, as well as Dominic Calvert-Lewin has played, at some point you're going to have to give Moise Keane a chance with, like, you know, a genuine first team out there that's not riddled with injuries, because, you know, whether it be 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, or 2 years from now, you're going to need an answer on the whole Moise Keane question, and playing him in a 4-4 freaking 2 under Duncan Ferguson isn't really getting the job done.
Or a 4-2-3-1 with wingers as Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison.
You know, let's wrap this thing up right now, though. First, we'll start with you.
As we've kind of discussed with all the injuries, I don't know how many long-term takeaways there are. I'm kind of tempted to revert back to something a little simplistic and just say that Leighton Baines is the dude. And he has always been that dude. And I think that he, you know, the euphoria lasted, but gosh, probably what, 10, 15 minutes of real time. But he deserved that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a great takeaway, and I agree. I don't think, much like the United match, there's not a whole lot to take away from it, just because we're seeing Duncan, the lads, do the best they can with what they've got. But yeah, as I said to Chris post-game, you know, I hopefully no offense to Leighton Baines, but hopefully it's the last, you know, time that Everton needs him in a meaningful match this season, what with only being left in the Premier League and the FA Cup and only going to last one game in the FA Cup. You expect Luca Digne will start just about every game here on out for left back. And this will be it probably for Baines here, or at least this will be it at Everton. And what a great way for a guy who's given everything that he's had to the club for so long, to get to go out, you know, really, even still with the loss, to really go out as the hero. And I hope, above all, I hope that his statue at the new stadium is him standing on the ball, shrugging his shoulders, asking where the open guy is, the way that he does every time he gets the ball, because it makes me laugh every single time. And you're right, Leighton. Where is the open man? Where is he?
Well, so two things real quick. Kind of the beauty of football and really of sports as a whole is that we can still fully enjoy that moment and reminisce about it 5 years from now, even though Everton lost the game, because there's really no replacing that feeling that all three of us got when that ball went in the net. And, you know, we're all in different parts of the United States and
sitting
separated
at our
by
desks,
thousands of miles and trying to not to get fired. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to remember that. And I'm probably going to forget about the result of this game within, what, 2 or 3 years, but I'm not going to forget about that goal. And I think that that's important. And I also think that, you know, Leighton Baines has perhaps been a little underappreciated as the years have gone by. I don't want to say that the signing of Luca Digne whitewashed him, but in a certain sense it did, because, you know, he was such a fixture for so long, and then all of a sudden, boom, gone. We've got the best left back in the league now.
And yeah. And to be fair to Leighton Baines today and also when he came in off the bench against United,
he's pretty decent.
He was fine. Yeah. You know, Gino and I talked last week about, you know, being concerned about the idea of Daniel James against Leighton Baines. And I was
terrified of Damari Gray against him.
And it all turned really much pretty much into non-factors. Yeah. And let's not, you know, lose track of the fact that he was taking set pieces in both of those games. Both those headers that we talked about that Yerry Mina should have scored on come from corners from Leighton Baines, because he was the only guy left. So, you know, he can still play.
And in true Leighton Baines fashion, when he scored the goal this afternoon, all of his teammates were freaking out, and he's just kind of like, that was cool, yeah. I guess.
Obviously, I hit the upper 90s. Obviously, come on. Have you met me?
I do that shit all the time.
But yeah, no, for sure. Seeing him score that goal, you know, Leighton Baines, from my perspective, first ever jersey I got, you know, the first real guy that, you know, when I started watching Everton, I was like, oh man, this Leighton Baines guy, he's pretty solid. And then you have the goals, you know, the goal against Newcastle. You know, it's up there with that goal from Leighton Baines.
The brace, of course, against West Ham.
West Ham. Oh.
Yeah. And then in terms of Everton goals that I've seen in my lifetime, you know, Phil Jagielka against Liverpool from the outside.
It's up there with the Jags.
I wrote that after the game today. I really do think right in that moment with the circumstances such as they were, it's up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But moving on now to the weekend, we will be playing Arsenal. I believe this is Saturday, correct, guys? Saturday, 7:30 a.m.?
Yeah, 7:30 a.m. Eastern time, yeah.
6:30 a.m. my time. Oh, baby.
7:30 a.m. over in England.
You got kids, man. You're going to be awake anyway. I don't want to hear it.
That's true. That's true.
But yeah, so Arsenal currently sitting in 10th place on 22 points. They have a total of 7 points from the last 9 Premier League games, which is something that even we have been able to. It's bad. On a not so promising side, Everton are 2-8-0 against Arsenal in the last 10 games. Both wins have come to Citizen.
That's good.
And this is a real chance, I think, for Everton to move up with 3 points. I think West Ham has Liverpool this week. Burnley and Newcastle are playing each other. So, and those are the teams that are separate us and Arsenal right now. So real chance for Everton to move up in this one. Probably big dunks, you know, last game in charge. How are we thinking he sets up? I mean, can't really set up any differently from the way he has the last few games, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be the same 4-4-2. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
The question will really just be, do we get the return of Gylfi Sigurdsson and Jabril Sidibe? And Sidibe, obviously, I don't think there's any doubt that Sidibe comes into the starting lineup if he's
just had a better season than Coleman has, honestly.
It's just that simple.
I believe he leads the team in assists. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he's up to four.
I will check that, but I believe you're correct. Yeah. And I think you have to start Sigurdsson. No disrespect to, as I said, to what Mason Holgate has done in the midfield for Everton in the last few games. He's done his best, but especially with the way that Michael Keane is playing right now, I'd really rather see Davies and Sigurdsson in the midfield and drop Holgate back alongside Mina, and then yes, probably see that same.
I do think Michael Keane needs maybe a couple weeks on the beach or,
Yeah, we'll see how that one plays out for Keane, but I agree with you guys there. I think
how good is Kurt Zuma, apparently, by the way?
To make Michael Keane look like that has to be pretty good considering the way he's been playing this year and really the way he played before Kurt Zuma.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, great point there. In terms of managerial bumps, Everton doesn't look like they'll have Ancelotti in place for this match, but it looks like Arsenal will, or definitely seems like a possibility that they'll have Arteta in place for this game. How does this affect us? Will it affect the way Arsenal play? Really anything with that affecting us in this game?
Well, I think Arsenal are definitely going to get a new manager bump for the reason that it's hard to be any worse than they've been over the last couple of weeks. I mean, they've lost to Brighton. They have drawn Standard Liège in the Europa League. They got drop kicked by Manchester City. They drew Norwich. They lost to Frankfurt. They lost to Leicester. They drew Southampton. They drew a team from the Portuguese League. Like, it is really, really bad. And Freddie Ljungberg is apparently also really bad. All that to say, I think it will affect the way Arsenal play. I don't think that Arteta will have time, of course, to get his whatever his system is into play, but I do think that despite playing for David Moyes and despite playing for Arsene Wenger, from everything that I've read, he's more of a Pep Guardiola disciple. And so that'll be interesting as a neutral observer moving forward with Arsenal anyway.
I don't necessarily know how much about Arsenal in terms of play style you can really change, just because in terms of personnel, they are who they are. Their defense is bad.
It's kind of amazing to look at a team that rich in world football and say that they could use like six new defenders, and that's not even really an exaggeration.
And they could probably use some midfield help too. And that's not to take anything away from the fact that, Aubameyang and Lacazette are very good. Martinelli has been a pleasant surprise for them. Pepe in theory is good. I haven't ever really seen that with my eyes, but that's what they tell me, is that he's supposed to be good. That this is an Arsenal team that's going to be capable of scoring goals. And to me, their midfield and their defense are so shambolic that really, until you can get new guys in, the only real option is to try to win games 6-5. Which sets up for an interesting dichotomy against an Everton team that will certainly come out looking to win 1-0, because that's really all they've got the personnel to do right now.
You're going to have, in terms of the respective midfields in this game, it's going to be the resistible force against the movable object.
Who's ready for Torreira and Guendouzi against Davies and Sigurdsson? Yeah. Boy. That's the good stuff.
Dollar Tree David Luiz.
David Luiz has been so bad, he's getting benched for Callum Chambers. That's
who
how
was
bad
that?
David Luiz has been.
Callum Chambers, who, lest you forget, was playing for Fulham last season.
Fulham had a terrible defense.
And if you recall, Fulham shipped a record number of goals.
Legitimately historically bad defense Fulham had last year. And Arsenal genuinely thought that bringing in David Luiz was going to fix their problems on defense. Oh, Arsenal, never change.
I do kind of want a Yerry Mina David Luiz off, though.
Ooh.
I would enjoy that brand of center back crazy.
I like it.
I think Mina would win. I mean, come on.
Yeah, Yerry Mina, actually good.
A better center back than David Luiz, but they both do kind of have this crazy man tendency.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Other than Yerry Mina going off and, you know, getting that crazy mentality and possibly getting a red card, I guess you could say, what about this game worries you?
Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first and last answer. Yeah.
He's very good. I would go so far as to say he's very, very good. In fact,
he should not be playing for the 10th best team in England. Let's put it that way.
No, and Arsenal have proven that they really are that too. That table doesn't lie at this stretch of the season, and we can admit that as Everton fans. Right. We know it to be true. Aubameyang is dangerous. Like I said, I hope that Sigurdsson is back and healthy so that we can have a center back pairing of Holgate and Mina, so that we've got a little bit more pace to deal with Aubameyang's pace. Because if it does have to be Keane, if I'm Arsenal, I'm picking on that matchup all fucking day.
I'm just running right at him.
Yeah, exactly.
Make a decision there. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's going to be, I'm praying we do not have to see Michael Keane go up against Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, because that would probably be a disaster. But we said the same thing for Man United, and we only gave up one goal in that game. So.
And it was not to Marcus Rashford or Anthony Martial, so what the hell do we know?
Yeah, exactly. We don't know anything.
I'm happy we could do our part for the Manchester United mouth breathers who now think that Mason Greenwood is Wayne Rooney 2.0. I'm going to really enjoy that.
The comparisons that came out after the game were pretty crazy. Like Robin Van Persie was compared to him at a point. There's a lot. But getting back to Arsenal, how do Everton get a result?
They punch Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and then wait for Callum Chambers or Socrates to gift them a goal. It's pretty much the Chelsea formula all over again. And really, this is, again, a team much like Chelsea, much like United. Really, a lot of pace up top, some dangerous attackers, a midfield that is going to struggle to break down a deep-lying block, and a defense that's going to gift you a chance or two at a goal. It worked against Chelsea. It worked against United. You don't have to squint real hard to see how it works against Arsenal as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to getting a result is just the good old rope-a-dope, right? Like,
yeah.
sit super deep and make Lacazette and Aubameyang and Nicola Pepe get frustrated, and then hope you bounce one in off somebody's butt.
Yeah, or off somebody's dick.
Yeah, well, that's more realistic.
Yeah, that's you're absolutely right.
Hopefully, Victor Lindelof has recovered. Might have to cut that part too.
Predictions for this game, Chris. We'll start with you.
I'm gonna go 1-1. I just Arsenal are really, really bad, guys. Like, if you haven't watched much of them this season, it is truly horrific. And the only reason they're in the table spot that they are is Aubameyang and Lacazette deserve better.
Well, this I would say is the perfect test of Duncan Ferguson's revitalizing the team, in the sense that a team that's really, really bad is going to come to Goodison, and we're going to see if they actually, you know, break that chain like they have in recent past, and or if Everton can, you know, pull out a win like they should pull out a win, or at least a draw like they should. Adam, your prediction in this one?
1-0 Everton all the way. I feel it. We're going to get us a clean sheet. I feel it.
Wow.
Arsenal is bad, and they're going to do it for Big Dunk. I think Goodison once again will be rocking. And, yeah, I don't know. I just got a feeling about this one that we nick another stupid early one, and then we just tell Arsenal, na-na-na-na-na, come and get it.
Just the Jordan Pickford's pass map is going to be incredible.
Yeah, just all red. Big red lines as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, I mean, I can't – I'm not as optimistic about the clean sheet, but I am optimistic in the sense that I think we could win this one. So I'm just going to go with the same scoreline I've gone with, I think, for the past, like, 5 weeks. 2-1. 2-1 to Everton, and we'll see how that plays out.
At some point, you know you're going to be right.
At some point, exactly.
Odds are.
You exactly. Almost had it today.
Almost had it today.
Like half our friggin' writers picked it 2-1 today, and then Leighton Baines had to go all Leighton Baines on this.
But that's okay. It brought us excitement. That's the kind of situation that I enjoy. If it was the other way around and say James Maddison made it 2-2, then I would not enjoy it as much, obviously. Moving on to the final things, you know, we want to catch you up on some things that have been going around the Everton universe recently. We'll move over to our toffee topics. And the biggest thing happening right now for Everton, other than the games they play in week in and week out, is the managerial search. And it looks like it's pretty complete. Our old friend Sean Lunt came out with some stuff today that was from the Italian Corriere dello Sport, saying Ancelotti's set to agree a 4.5-year deal for 28 million euros, 6 million a year. He also has insurances over the transfer window and Moise Keane in particular, which we will get to, and that he'll be in charge for the Burnley game on Boxing Day if things go to plan. That was right before we started recording, when Paul Joyce, one of the top guys that we know around Everton and around Liverpool, said that Everton are set to appoint Ancelotti on a £9 million a year deal. It says that he's still working on getting the severance package determined with he'll probably, it looks like he'll take place or he'll take charge for the Burnley game as well, he states. So guys, first off, let's go financial. Chris, we'll start with you. Thoughts on the money we are paying? We seem to be paying for Ancelotti, and it seems to be that it'll be a record deal for an Everton manager.
Well, on the one hand, it's not my money, so I don't care. On the other hand, when we sack him in 18 months, that is going to cost a crap ton. Yeah, absolutely monumental stack of cash to get rid of him.
Yeah.
In 2 years or whatever it's going to be.
I am not Farhad Moshiri, so I will echo Chris's sentiments that it's not my money. I think he's a big ol' idiot, but I also think he's a big ol' idiot with enough money that he don't give a fuck if he has to pay a butt ton of money to Carlo Ancelotti when we sack him in 2 years, because what's a lot of money to us is not a lot of money to him.
It's just a completely different world that we have no way to grasp. I mean that's the type of money that Farhad Moshiri has like lost in a morning.
Yeah.
As long as the investment into Ancelotti is not in any way prohibitive to the club making player acquisitions, I don't care how much Farhad decides to pay his manager. And I see no reason why we should think that those two things would, not be able to coexist. So for me,
as long as he held back enough money to extend Luka Dean's contract.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, it certainly seems that, Ancelotti wasn't coming here to spend a boatload of cash in the January transfer window and in the summer window. So, you would think that would be true. But I thought the interesting thing about this was the Keane assurances from what Sean said. Obviously, Keane's situation so far has been pretty interesting. Obviously, hasn't been used too much. And then, of course, the thing with Man United today playing, putting in a pretty good shift. There was an article, an article by The Athletic that was released that was interesting on the Keane situation. But the big thing that I took out of it was Marco Silva and Marcel Brands put together a list of names that they wanted in the summer transfer window, and Moise Kean was initially on that list. Now that Marco Silva is no longer here and there will be a different man controlling this team, Carlo Ancelotti, who seems to like Moise Kean, how does this affect him?
I think it's of all the players at Everton, I think the Ancelotti appointment is probably best for Kean, right? He plays a more sophisticated, we'll say, style of football than the other Everton strikers. They're both Italian. excuse me. They're both Italian, and Ancelotti has shown a reasonable affinity for playing young players through his career. I believe that Isco got his start at Real Madrid under Ancelotti, and James Rodriguez as well, and other players like that. So I don't know. I think Kean will be encouraged.
Yeah, agreed. I don't have a whole lot more to add to that. There's not a whole lot of room for things to get much worse than they were for him under Marco Silva toward the end. So it'll be interesting to see how he is impacted. And I think that part of it will also depend on what Carlo Ancelotti and what Marcel Brands and Farhad Moshiri and everyone's kind of goals are for the second half of the season. You know, if we come out of the holiday, fixture crunch, sitting comfortably in 10th place and having really removed ourselves from the relegation battle, but still not really in the battle for a European position, how much leeway is Ancelotti going to have to just kind of fuck around and do some stuff out there to see what sticks and who works and who doesn't to figure out what we'll have going forward into the coming years? And obviously, right now I don't have an answer for that, but it's Kean will be impacted by that decision more than most, I would think.
Well, it's kind of an interesting equation, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this in the weeks to come, but both Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Moise Kean need to be playing, and they need to be playing a lot. And the way that Everton's roster is constructed, it's not exactly the best idea to play two strikers at one time. So I'll be interested to see how that's handled, especially since, as Adam mentioned earlier, we're going to be down to one competition pretty shortly.
Yeah.
Such confidence about that FA Cup fixture we've got.
Although Ancelotti has beaten Jurgen Klopp, I think, twice, but with significantly better teams.
What does it mean to beat Jurgen Klopp? I'm not familiar with this idea.
Well, people beat Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, not very many people are familiar with that at this point.
Building on what you said, Chris, they are both Italian, so that language barrier probably will be, or at least breaking that language barrier between Ancelotti and Kean or Kean and his manager will certainly help that situation. And like you said, I think, like both you guys said, I think it definitely helps him. If Ancelotti comes in, obviously, if he won a trophy, that would be great. That would be the good that Ancelotti can do for Everton. But other than, winning a trophy and, putting us in Champions League, what are some of the good that Ancelotti can bring to Everton, being the manager, starting probably in a week?
Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
The experience, I think we've talked about kind of our concerns with the negative, that most of his experience has come with clubs that have had more talent and bigger budgets and all of that. But I think the experience that he brings of week to week, being managing a top team, and the expectation that he's going to have of his players and of the club is a positive thing, and it brings a level of experience that we've certainly never seen from an Everton manager in our lifetime. So that to me is encouraging. Obviously, some of that needs to be tempered based on the talent that's available. But as long as Carlo's got a good understanding of that, the mentality that he can bring based on the experience that he has, I think ultimately is positive.
Yeah, and the only thing that I would add to that is that if you look around the world of club managers, Ancelotti is probably, would you say maybe top five, top six or seven in terms of A, name recognition, and B, just shit one.
Yeah.
And there's value in that. Like that's, you know, I have expressed elsewhere some major hesitancy in just appointing a celebrity manager like this, but there are some things that come along with that, and you know, player recruitment may see some improvement in particular. So that would kind of be my take on it.
Moving to the final thing we want to talk about today, something we don't really talk about too much on this podcast, but definitely deserves a lot of attention, the Everton women's team. First off, a big congratulations to their manager, Willie Kirk, who was named the manager of the month for November. Team, and Adam can I'm sure speak to these things a little bit better than I can, but you know, led the team to a pretty good month there. And then now they've recently been linked to Izzy Christensen of Lyon. As many of those who follow women's soccer in Europe know, Lyon is one of the best, well, is the best team,
The best is the
the
best.
best team bar none in Europe. Talk to us a little bit about really the Everton women's team, how Willie Kirk has been, you know, performing as manager, and then this link to Izzy Christensen.
Well, I was certainly concerned over the offseason, and I know Rachel, who does the majority of our Everton women's coverage over on the site, you know, we were a little bit concerned coming into the season. Everton finished next to last in the league last year, and the team that finished below them, they didn't get relegated, but they went bankrupt basically. So we were definitely concerned about relegation. Willie Kirk's moves over the offseason were basically bringing in the top goalkeeper from Finland, one quasi-experienced Dutch player, and a couple of English younger players. And somehow he has turned a group that was 10th in the league last year and made those changes to a team that's fifth in the league through 9 games. They sit at 5 wins and 4 losses, lost 3-1 to Arsenal last week, which is
No
an
shame
achievement,
in that, yeah.
which is an achievement because Arsenal has beaten a team, what was it, 10-0, I think, earlier, 9-0 or 10-0 earlier in the season. So the fact that they have been
Arsenal
comfortably
beat Bristol City 11-1, and then they
11 to
beat
1. There it is.
then they beat the London Bees in the FA Cup 9-0.
Yeah, they shouldn't be playing second division teams ever, ever. So very encouraging that they are a team that's stable right now, you know, sitting at 15 points. If you had offered us 15 points at the start of the season for the entirety of the season, I might have taken it because I might have thought it would have been good enough to keep them from getting relegated, and they're at that through 9 matches. So, I mean, cannot be overstated how far above expectations this team has punched in so far. And then, as you phrased, the Izzy Christensen link came from The Athletic earlier today. Christensen is a player who played with the English national team at the last Euros a couple of years ago, would have most likely made the World Cup roster, the England World Cup roster, if not for injury, and is a player who, as we said, is playing at Lyon, not a ton of minutes, but anybody who Lyon even sees value in has to be a pretty gosh darn good player. And this is, without a doubt, the biggest name that the Everton women have been linked to since the inception of the FA Women's Super League 4 or 5 years ago. It is an absolutely massive opportunity for this club to prove that it can be a place where these kind of mid-level international players for not only for England but for other top European nations, like Norway, like Sweden, like the Netherlands, like France, that for players who are kind of in on the fringes of those national teams to be able to have a club that they can go to where they can regularly expect playing time and have a reasonable chance to succeed. If Christensen does indeed come to Everton Women and can do that, it is a chance for it to be an enormous springboard for similar signings like that in the future, because clubs like that, that are kind of your comfortably mid-table, but still attractive to quality players, just don't exist in the women's game in Europe. You can go play in the NWSL here in the States and kind of find that, but in Europe, you're either a Lyon or an Arsenal or a Manchester City, or you're an other. And right now, the way that Everton is trending is such that they could really carve out a unique niche in the middle, in that upper middle level of the English top division. And that is a really exciting proposition for a club that looked, you know, just 9 months ago like it would be in serious danger of being relegated.
Well, it I don't follow this as close as you do, but it bears noting to me as well that this is kind of something that we haven't seen before in terms of commitment to investing in the actual roster, right? Like
that, it'll be interesting to see.
The way that I've heard you talk about it in the past, and the way that I've seen a little bit, is that they've improved around the fringes, right? Like they've never taken a big swing at a position like this.
Correct. Christensen's contract with Lyon is up at the end of this season. The rumor is that she will move to Everton in January. Whether or not that means Lyon hits Everton up for a transfer fee, or because she is coming off of an injury and has not been featuring for them, Lyon just kind of shrugs its shoulders and says, we're happy to get her off the wage bill and just move her somewhere where she'll be more content. We'll have to see. If it does turn out to be the case, indeed, that there is a transfer fee involved, then yes, absolutely, 100%, this would be indicative of a huge shift in player recruitment and just prioritization of the women's team in general at Everton. We just don't know for sure at this point if that's going to be the case or not. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on as hopefully a move comes to fruition.
And for those out there who, you know, are maybe new to what we're talking about, Christensen did play for Manchester City before she went to Lyon. And, you know, she missed the World Cup with injury, I believe, but there's some quotes floating around out there from England manager Phil Neville, who I think intended to take her with him to the World Cup.
Absolutely.
She just wasn't able to. So,
yeah. Yeah, she absolutely would have made the World Cup team over the summer, and is also has roots at Everton. You know, it's not something that we've talked about a lot, but in the kind of the iteration of the English women's top division before it went pro and became what is now known as the FA Women's Super League, Everton was regularly alongside Manchester City, one of the best clubs out there. So she's come through the ranks at Everton, then moved along with a lot of other players in that era to Manchester City and then to Lyon, and now hopefully back home to Everton.
Yeah, I believe she was at Everton like 2008, 2009 range, somewhere in there.
Correct.
Awesome. That, you know, it's great seeing the Everton women do well. You know, it's great seeing any Everton team do well, but you know, like you said, Adam, with them dealing with relegation last year, it's good to see them take that next step up and now be linked with these players that could really change the shape of their team, you know, moving forward, and the shape of Everton's women's, you know, team moving forward. Something that we did not talk about. Good. All right. All right. That's it. That's all we got. We got nothing else. We'll be back next week. Obviously next week's Christmas, so we won't be releasing the same time as we normally do.
You don't want to celebrate Christmas with us, Gino? I'm hurt.
Come on.
I'm hurt.
I mean, if you guys want to celebrate Christmas together, I certainly can, but I can't imagine that you know.
Well, I might need a couch to sleep on and a lawyer, but.
But yeah, exactly. So we'll be releasing a little different time next week, but we will be with you guys next week. You know, I'm assuming by next week we'll have a new manager in Carlo Ancelotti, and we'll kind of start to get a feel for what things are like under his you know, under his reign for Everton. So until then, Adam, Chris, thank you as always, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Peace.